You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer and joining me today is our data editor, Simon Baker. Hi, Simon.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming in. We've got quite a few data heavy stories as we actually always do. So I wanted to just bring you in to talk about some of the bigger features that you've published in the past month or so, because I think there's some really interesting articles that maybe our listeners haven't had a chance to read or come across yet. The first one that I wanted to talk about was looking at the rise of China, which is obviously something that's in national press with the story of Huawei is what I'm thinking of specifically, but just this constant competition that China has with the rest of the world, which is this narrative that I think is just consistently touched upon in every news story. So it's interesting that you've looked at it within the context of the research landscape. So can you start off by just kind of talking us through what the main angle of your research was for this piece?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, but I suppose the starting point was this kind of underlying narrative that we've had for the last few years about China's rise in research.
Right.
And the starting point was really to kind of look at the figures on sort of China's research. Is it actually kind of catching the US and what do we mean by that when we say it's catching the US?
Right.
It's very simple to say that, but
is it volume? Is it quality?
Exactly. What are we talking about?
Right.
So to kind of dig deeper into those kind of issues, raise a question about really whether the figures could be relied on, because often there's a lot of talk about whether the research is coming out of some of the research is coming out of China, is there any kind of misconduct going on there?
Right.
So I looked at that issue as well, and then really to think about, okay, so let's take that question and say, so is China is going to catch the US on whatever measure we're talking about? What does that mean for world research, really?
Right.
So kind of really three main kind of core pillars to the piece.
So just walk us through the stats, the stats that you use in this piece. What are some of the indicators that you've used to show China's growth, either in volume or quality, and how that compares to the US specifically and Europe, I think you touch on as well?
Yeah, so I kind of looked at the US, China, and the EU 28, whether that will become 27 or not, we'll see. if you look at volume, basically, China's rise has just been quite astonishing.
Mm.
It's almost caught the US. It's going to happen in the next couple of years if you look at overall number of papers published.
Mm.
Europe has gone up quite a lot as well, but maybe a sort of that's kind of flatlined a little bit in the last few years. I suppose that's something to do with the kind of less developed parts of Europe catching up and their research capacity going up. But if you still look at kind of relative to the size of the population in China, firstly, then they're still way behind. You know, if you think about just how many people are in the US or Europe, then if they were actually producing the amount of research relative to their population, they should be four times ahead.
Really. Right.
So you should bear that in mind to start with. And then
can I just ask you there, why does that matter? Why does it matter what the research output is per population?
I think really because at the end of the day, if you're trying to think of how developed a country is and its economic growth and how sustainable that is, then and whether that's sustaining the population, then you have to kind of think about the number of researchers and the amount of research is going on relative to those people.
Mm.
I think that's kind of helpful context to put in there. And that just reminds you that China is still, okay, its cities might be developing at an astonishing rate, but you go away from those cities and China's still not a developed country to the extent that maybe sort of some parts of the West are.
Right.
You know, that's one thing to bear in mind. Are they kind of rapidly improving and increasing their research that's going to change the lives of everyone in China?
Mm.
That's one thing to kind of think about. But then also, when you look at quality, the picture is a bit more mixed. So if you look at, say, the overall kind of average quality, something we call field-weighted citation impact, which takes the and you could argue quite a lot about whether citation impact is a good measure of quality anyway, but you're saying that how often papers are cited, and on average across all research, China is kind of slowly creeping up on the US and Europe. If you look at just the sort of growth rate, then you could suggest that maybe by the mid-2020s China would have caught the US. But you know, that depends on lots of things. Really, we're talking about a normalized average. As that goes up, it's more likely to kind of tail off, because you're looking at it relative to the rest of the world. So there's a question mark over that. And then when you look at sort of the most highly cited research and the number of Chinese researchers that are getting papers in you know, the top journals, then they're still quite a long way behind the US, but yeah, improving very, very quickly, and have taken over a lot of other countries. And 10, 15 years ago, China wouldn't have been kind of in the picture after the US. You'd have other countries that were set, but now they're clearly second.
One figure from this piece that I thought was quite astonishing was just the rate of growth, which you just touched on, the rate of growth that China is showing. And I think it was when you were talking about the volumes that the...
Yeah, I mean, just to give you an example, 1997, the total volume of research from China in terms of the number of papers published of a certain type, where we looked at articles, reviews and conference papers, was somewhere below 50,000 for 1997, whereas the US was producing about 350,000.
Right.
2017, China was producing over 500,000. It's got up 10 times in that, that period. Whereas the US produced more, but approaching sort of 600,000.
Okay.
But you know, percentage wise, the difference is kind of quite staggering.
Yeah. Closing the gap quite quickly.
Yeah.
What are some of the problems? Obviously, there are massive investments, and this growth isn't coming from nowhere. There are massive investments on the part of the Chinese government to do this. But obviously, with such growth comes some problems as well.
Yeah, I mean, the key issue that I looked at here is that there are massive incentives to publish research in China. That monetary incentives, you know, for people, as well as promotional, you know, incentives in certain quarters. And the worry is that, and this is not just goes for sort of any paper as well, it could be if you paper, you know, get a paper published in a highly cited journal, for instance as well. And the worry is that if those incentives are there, then it obviously is going to encourage some kind of misconduct.
Right.
And just to sort of give some examples, one of the sort of big misconduct worries about research coming out of China is fake peer review. And this is basically what happens here is that a researcher may look for a journal might ask a researcher to suggest some sort of people that could peer review a paper, and then they give an email address out, and that actually then links back to someone connected to the researcher or a company that's working for them, and then they write a glowing review of this article, then it gets published.
Right.
And the kind of the sort of worrying thing is that there's been a few examples of kind of major example of dozens of papers having to be retracted because this happened, and in kind of just a few journals. And is that the tip of the iceberg? I mean, it could be. Could this be going on more? We don't know about it. So, you know, I've spoken to various... The Chinese government has brought in kind of quite draconian measures to try and tackle this, and saying that anyone caught with misconduct, they're going to be banned for life for working in academia.
Okay.
But you know, then the fear is that anyone kind of caught up in one of these scandals gets tarred with a brush wrongly and doesn't get sort of a proper investigation and go through a due legal process. Mm. So the people I've spoken to say, well, really, you need to deal with the incentives, because otherwise, you know, these things, if it's not fake peer review, it might be something else. I mean, there isn't any kind of killer smoking gun evidence to say that you can't trust the bibliometric data out there on China.
So I was going to say, there's no hard data showing the rate of plagiarism or false peer review.
There's nothing out there to say, oh, right, we should take the overall figures with a real pinch of salt to this degree, because there's just kind of, there's some examples of, we know how many fake peer review retractions there have been, for instance, over the last few years, and China comes out on top by quite a long chalk. But it's difficult to kind of then extrapolate that to overall figures on research quality and publication and say, right, we can't trust them.
Right.
And I think it would be wrong to kind of personally to sort of say, all right, you can't trust any of these figures about China. It's not really catching the US.
Yeah.
That would be a mistake, especially by a country like the US, to do that and say, oh, we shouldn't worry about this because we're not sure what they're doing is legitimate anyway, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder if there's an element of prejudice here, and if there's a greater scrutiny upon China just because of the threat that it does pose, and because the US and the EU kind of hold the reins of power in terms of the scientific world. And I mean, even research fraud exists in the United States. Yes. Like, we saw Duke University paying the country's largest research grant fund settlement of $113 million for research fraud.
Yeah.
So it happens everywhere. So
every country has got its example of something pretty murky or a kind of major news grabbing example of research misconduct. So you've got to be very careful there's also a kind of argument to say that the bias could be biased the other way, so that I think probably there are a lot of peer review takes place in the West. There might be an argument to say that people are gonna, it might be harder for Chinese researchers, legitimate Chinese researchers, to get their papers kind of cited by Western researchers or getting a good peer review when it's a legitimate peer review. So, you know, I think we just have to take the bibliometric data on face value and think about what that means for the world of research, really.
Yeah.
Because on that evidence, then within another 10 years, China could be seen as the leading research nation in the world, possibly.
That would be quite a dramatic change in the world of science.
And kind of the rest of my piece goes into kind of what that might mean, really, in terms of science and what the dangers are about it. I mean, kind of the positive thing I took from it is that it may, at the end of the day, if China is so engaged in world research networks and science like this, and has to be to kind of improve, then that gives it a kind of opening to the rest of the world, and forces China, and means China cannot afford to pull down the walls and kind of cut itself off from the world. So I think that's a positive thing to say. But a lot of the kind of issues I go into in the rest of the piece is China's rise and its kind of involvement in research networks compatible with a political system which is which is not democratic, and then the dangers of that, really.
Interesting. It's dangers that I'm sure plenty of people have at the front of their minds quite regularly. Speaking about this world of science, I think that's a nice segue to your next piece, which was looking at, as you're flipping through the magazine that both these pieces are in, you looked at the growth of PhD graduates over a series of decades.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think, first of all, tell us what the stats were on that. You were looking at PhD graduates in the UK, US, and Australia. Is that right?
Yeah. So the UK figures are the first thing that kind of alerted me to this issue, really, because the most recent data on PhD completion, sort of by subject area, if you look at from 2013-14 to 2017-18, then if you look at the chain, the biggest growth areas in the number of PhDs that are being awarded, the top growth areas maths, computer science, subjects added to medicine, biological sciences. The areas where there's been a lot less growth, languages, education, social studies is down there as well. So the
humanities. So we've got a clear difference between growth and PhD students, graduates in STEM versus humanities.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of made me think, right, let's have a look at some other countries.
Right.
The US has got some excellent data on this. Basically, it publishes a report on PhD completions every year. And you can sort of go back all the way to 1987, actually, I think I did with this with this data. But it's really interesting because you look at the sort of the different areas there. Education PhDs, just as a sort of percentage. I looked at the US doctoral sort of recipients by percentage in each major sort of field of study. And it's just sort of fallen constantly over that period, 1987 to 2017, in education. Humanities and the arts kind of went up a little bit, but then it's fallen back. Life sciences, it's just gone up and up and up.
So similar trends.
Yeah.
Going back even further for the US that you saw in the UK.
Yeah, exactly. And and then I kind of also looked at Australia as well, where it's a slightly different picture because basically there's just been a lot of growth everywhere.
Right.
In PhDs. Which
is the narrative we've been getting from Australia.
Yeah, exactly.
For
it's just like
a number of years, just boom in enrollments.
Yeah. But their engineering was kind of had seen the most growth.
Okay.
So you're still looking at a technical subjects there, and the kind of creative arts, society and culture actually had the lowest growth, even though it was still kind of talking about 20% over like 8 years. So that just got me to explore the issue a little bit more and why this is happening. I mean, a big part of it is that a lot of people think that when it comes to you do a humanities PhD, your career route is much more kind of fixed in terms of it's really academia is the major thing that you might go into.
Right.
You might be able to go work for a think tank or there might be other things you can do, but really that's the major obvious career path. Science, your PhD can be used.
All over.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you can get a
outside
job
outside of academia.
Yeah. And there's a big demand for that as well.
Right.
So that's the major kind of thing you have to think about here.
So it's labour market forces essentially that are causing this.
Yeah, exactly.
This difference, this discrepancy.
Yeah. And what's interesting in the US, speaking to some experts out there, is there's a kind of a cycle there, where you see the number of academic jobs for early career research in the humanities kind of drift down, and then you see a few years later they're not. There's a fall in the number of people taking PhDs.
Interesting. Right.
But because there's the PhD takes a few years to do, and it might take a little while for that to kind of that feedback to happen. There's a lag. But you can see a definite kind of cycle there and a lag where it's connected.
So it's all quite cyclical then, because if humanities departments are decreasing in size, potentially due to the lack of funding. Then that means that obviously they're going to be less attractive places for PhD candidates to potentially see themselves working.
Yeah, exactly. And well, I mean, I suppose the other aspect of this is I looked at whether, certainly in America and the UK in the last 10 years, there has been at times a lot of rhetoric about from politicians about whether the humanities are kind of worth investing in terms of students taking those subjects and whether they then get a career out of it. And there's been a bit of an emphasis on, well, no, they should be doing STEM. Really, that's what they're going to get.
Of course,
that's what they're going to make money out of. And whether that's fed into this cycle. A lot of people said to me, well, probably not PhD level. I mean, someone chooses to do a PhD is not going to really take any notice of that. But what is at the base of all this is undergraduate education. So somebody deciding to do a humanities undergraduate degree is then if the more of them that who then get first, the more you're going to have that want to do a PhD, and if those that they're being put off doing those subjects, then there's less likely to be, and then you build into that the fact that if less undergraduates are doing humanities degrees, there's less money going to those departments because they're paying tuition fees. So those departments contract, and that then affects what you can, what you might do in terms of the numbers that do a PhD. So it's all. I think the conclusion was that this kind of emphasis on STEM does affect really PhD, people doing PhDs in the long run as well.
But Australia was a bit different. I mean, there was growth in Australia.
Yeah,
what's happening there?
I mean, I think you can see similarities between the US and the UK, but Australia is a slightly different case because everything was booming.
Yeah.
And that has a lot to do with international students, I think. And you're just having a lot of international students come into the country. And
even though they're traditionally more STEM focused?
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably need to dig a lot more into the data on the kind of humanities PhDs there and what's happening and whether they're Australian domestic sort of students who then are going on and taking those degrees. And
if they're staying in academia, if they're taking them out elsewhere to jobs in the industry or
what they're doing afterwards. I mean, one thing that was kind of pointed out to me was that it's a little bit simplistic to sort of think a PhD in the humanities or social sciences is just then all you've got to do is go and work in academia. Really, we should be making much more, and a lot of people are trying to do this, make the case for those PhDs being very useful outside of academia, because they are, really. More and more people need the sort of analysis that you do in social sciences and the context of putting data and science in when it comes to humanities to actually come up with. I mean, an example that was pointed out to me was social media, really. And Facebook and Google. Okay, those things are all run on algorithms and it's all about tech, but why they succeed and the issues that are brought up by the huge issues that are being brought up by social media at the moment in terms of influence in politics and how you fix that. Well, it's only the people who are most versed in humanities and social sciences that are going to be able to fix that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we're going to see a kind of not a backlash might be the wrong word, but in 10 to 20 years, a bit of a U-turn towards realizing that we need people that are talented in this area. Otherwise, we're looking at kind of major problems we're already looking at major problems politically for Western society.
Yeah, that is something that Carol Crisp brought up. Chancellor of UC Berkeley brought that up in January at a roundtable that I was hosting in Davos. But because obviously where they're placed, they've got quite a few partnerships with those big Silicon Valley companies, and they're asking more for humanities PhDs.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're asking for STEM graduates as well, but I think the companies are starting to realize the value that people with those degrees can have.
It's almost as if for that to happen, you kind of need the companies, you need to force them to need those graduates. Right? So the more regulation and politics kind of puts pressure on the big social media giants to kind of deal with these issues, then the more they might demand that kind of expertise.
Yeah, definitely in the case of social media, for sure. Yeah.
But I mean, that's obviously a narrow area. But it's just an example of where you do need, we're going to need people that are educated to that high level in those subjects.
We've touched a little bit about university funding and how that is affecting the PhD graduates and just the opportunities that are available to them and this whole ecosystem that exists in higher education. And you've covered a story recently looking at how institutions in the UK and England specifically are handling their finances. And you've come up with you found some pretty stark figures in the recent HESA data that was released, the Higher Education Statistics Agency.
So this is the UK's main body for collecting statistics about universities, and basically every year they kind of publish data on the overall picture, financial picture for the sector. But what was different this year is they published data that every provider finances. It's all available online for the first sort of open data policy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not been freely available in the past. You
so this
to
is
pay
the first time.
Yeah.
All right.
But so it means you could immediately look at how many universities are in deficit sort of this or were last year.
Okay.
And what's kind of slightly worrying is it has just been steadily climbing over the last few years.
Okay.
So basically, you look at the data for sort of England only. Last year, there were 32 out of 134 institutions posted a deficit. 24 the year before, and it was just 10 the year before that.
Interesting.
So,
and this is a deficit of 2% of their income. Is that what you?
Yeah, I mean that those figures there are just any.
Just any, you know, deficit.
Any sort of deficit.
Okay.
But yeah, those that have actually got a deficit of say over 5%, that's going up. That's been going up as well, and was virtually there were none, virtually no institutions a couple of years ago that had that. So I mean, it's not always. The deficit doesn't necessarily mean a university's in big financial
trouble, right.
But it just means over 1 year it was obviously spending more than it was the money it was bringing in,
right?
And over the long term, you know, you won't be able to keep doing that unless you've got some sort of source of you've got some assets that can kind of keep that can keep sort of funding that, basically. Some of the universities that have been going into deficit over the last few years and having repeated deficits, then some of them are those that they rely very heavily on fee income.
Mm-hmm.
And also that recruitment has fallen and that fee income has fallen. I mean, not all of them, there are different reasons for financial performance, but there's a definite trend there for some. And I just wrote up a new report by the Office for Students where they've looked at the forecast universities have given them about how many students they expect to recruit in the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically saying, we think that some of these are likely to be completely unachievable. Yeah, because I think what's going to happen after 2020 is that demographic dip in UK 18-year-olds is going to start to climb again, because there's been a sort of a baby boom about sort of 10, you know, the last sort of 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's going through schools at the moment. Schools can't cope with the numbers of kids. That's been a big issue. They're all going to go to university in about sort of 10 years. So a lot of universities are thinking, oh, we just hold on. That's mm-hmm. going to come and save us. Well, I think the OFS is saying, hold your horses, because that's only going to just start to turn around, and we think of being a bit unrealistic about.
Okay, so the estimations are a bit higher than what the reality will actually end up being. But I mean, it's funny that you say that a lot of the institutions that have the bigger deficits are the ones that are more reliant on student recruitment, presumably because they aren't research heavy institutions.
Yes,
so they don't have that research income.
Yep.
But you do mention in one of your pieces that even Cambridge has come out saying that it's got some cuts coming up.
Yeah, so we did a story where I think the Vice Chancellor of Cambridge wrote an email to staff saying that they were projecting a cash operating deficit this year of several million pounds, and they were having to sort of tighten their belts a bit,
right.
Which was a big sort of surprise. And Cambridge is never going to get into financial problems because it's one of, if not the wealthiest university in the country. It has a huge sort of endowment income. You would have to literally have a deficit every year for decades to ever be in trouble. I just don't, you know, but interesting that they're warning about that, because, you know, it means that there's, even at that kind of university, there is something going on where costs are going up too fast for the income that they're bringing in. And they're having to think about like pulling those costs back. And it was interesting that in this OFS report, they were saying that the most selective universities, i.e. the research intensives, were projecting this year the biggest kind of drop in their average sort of surplus. And it was saying that might be linked to kind of worries about increasing pension costs.
Right.
So that might be one factor there.
Which is a whole other story that
think
we've got time to go into.
For me to kind of go into now, definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much, Simon. I think that's three really interesting stories, kind of highlighting the deep dives into data that you do every week on THE. So thanks very much for coming in.
No problem. Yeah, I hope it's good.
And if you want to find any of Simon's stories, you can, of course, always look on timeshighereducation.com. And if you've got any questions or suggestions for me for the podcast, do get in touch, sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.